Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we've got in the studio a co-host, Russ Chianelli. But we're really going to be talking to a young lady from Great Britain. She's a professor of geological sciences at the University of Bristol, down there in the sort of southwest area of Great Britain. Her name is Frances Cooper, and she's into, in such a big way, a big issue, tectonics. Tectonics is what creates mountains. And so this is a big topic to be doing. And so, Frances, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely a pleasure to host you also. Before we get into the big things like tectonics, let's get into the operator here, you.
Okay.
Why are you a scientist? How did you become a scientist?
Well, I always had a passion for science when I was at school. And I studied science for my final exams at school. So I did maths, physics and geography, A-level, which is sort of the final exams we do at the age of 18 in the Great British system. And that combination of subjects was sort of a natural segue into geological sciences. So the mathematics and the physics, you know, underpinning the science, and the geography was what really exposed me to understanding the planet, how it works.
Now, you grew up where exactly?
I grew up in Greenwich in London.
Greenwich.
So, I'm a city girl.
Well, but I mean, the point being, there's a whole history in Greenwich. The Greenwich Observatory,
absolutely.
Greenwich Mean Time.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of science. Does that sort of come across when you went to school there?
Absolutely. Yes, growing up in Greenwich, big maritime history there as well. A lot of really interesting scientific discoveries. Harrison's clocks are very famous. How you tell the time at sea was a big story.
How you know where you are at sea.
That was what was important, you know,
right.
these long voyages. And so all those sort of historical things. I remember going to the Natural History Museum as a child a lot, going to the Science Museum, and they'd have some lots of old mechanisms and machines that you could play with and press the button and get everything working. And it was all really fascinating.
So you like to fiddle?
I like to fiddle with things, yes.
So geology was natural from your interests. How does a geologist decide what to do? There's so many options. I mean, I suppose it's a silly question because I'm a chemist and there's so many areas. Periodic tables, 116 elements. Why choose one? But what were the processes where you chose what to study?
Well, the great thing about geology is it's an extremely broad subject. It covers all the sciences, you know, from physics to chemistry to biology. And so the nice thing is whatever you choose to do in geology, you can actually bring together a lot of different subjects, a lot of different sciences. Physics was sort of what I had been doing mostly at school. And so structural geology, tectonics has more of the physical aspects to it.
When did you first know tectonics meant? How old were you when you knew the word tectonics?
I must have known about it when I was doing my geography, because we did geography at school. It wasn't geology. Actually, geology as a subject wasn't offered at my school. But the teacher I had had done a degree in geology, so she could have put a geological emphasis on the geography that we did.
Well, so what's the youngest memory you have of science? I mean, I know that I've talked to kids that were growing around their backyard and they pulled up a rock and they saw something under it and said, oh, I'm going to figure out what that is when I grow up.
I was never really the sort of rock collecting child geologist, I have to say. Really, my interest in geology came later, in my teens, I would say. I grew up more in a family interested in history and culture, and we'd go to, you know, spend lots and lots of holidays and weekends going to ancient castles or, you know, historical homes and Roman ruins and those kind of things. And
so
interest in history,
yes,
has a lot to do with geology too. You know, you're just looking on a very different time scale. So I do think that historical side of life I found very fascinating. And bring that together with science, for me, that teasing out the story, you know, how did what we see today come to be?
So, where did you go to college? When you left high school, you got your A-levels,
yep.
Sure you did very well, and then what?
Well, actually, after that, I took a year off. I did a gap year, and I went off to Africa. I worked in Zimbabwe for about 6 months, and I did teaching in some rural schools in Zimbabwe, which was incredible. This was in 1999. And then did some sort of backpacking through Mozambique and South Africa and
oh,
went to see as many places as I wanted. And this really you know, sparked me even more in my interest in adventure and travel. And I think the other side to geology that alongside the science is the ability to travel, to see parts of the world that, you know, most people don't get to see. And being able to do science in the great outdoors is one of the things that's so good about it. Yeah. So the gap year sort of, I'd already decided I was going to do a geology degree, but my year off in Zimbabwe and Southern Africa really sort of got me excited.
Well, there's a lot of history in Southern Africa. I mean, absolutely. You know, for, especially for the British.
Yes. Yeah. It was a fascinating place to be. It was an interesting time to be there in 1999. There were a lot of big political changes around that time. And Zimbabwe was about to undergo some big transformation in around 2000. So we were there just before that time. But it was a brilliant trip, and it really kind of helped prepare me for my degree. When I got back, I started my undergraduate degree at University College London, which is UCL in central London. And I did a four-year degree program there. So sort of 3 years and then plus a master's year that was combined. And in my senior thesis, I did a project in Greece looking at extensional faulting in the Gulf of Corinth.
I'm just totally jealous of you guys. I mean, you know, oh, where
brilliant.
Would you like to visit? Oh, I New Zealand. Oh, well, you know, the Otago Plateau or something, right? There's always something.
There's always
somewhere
to go.
Right.
No, I was very lucky to go and do that. And I went pretty much on my own, which probably wouldn't be allowed now. And I just sort of was walking along the coast, you know, taking measurements and go for a swim and then go back to the hotel.
Enough already. Okay, let's get to
So where's your next plan to go?
Well, actually, I've never been to New Zealand. That's very high on my list.
Good.
Just need to think
okay,
about how.
So you get a bachelor's degree
yes.
in geological sciences. You've learned all about tectonics. And then you go for a PhD. And
yes.
you. Just if I can say it, you started in London
I
and
did.
Then you had the good fortune that your mentor decides
yes.
to go to the University of Southern California.
That's right. Yes.
That brings you over to North America.
Yes. So I started my degree at UCL. I was going to stay put. And then about 6 months into my program, my PhD supervisor called me in and said, broke the news to me that he had been offered a job at the University of Southern California and would I like to go with him? And after some deliberation, I decided that, yes, that would be an amazing opportunity. So I found myself at the age of 24 moving to LA. Had never been there before. So you can imagine it was quite a culture shock. But I had an amazing time there, and I was there for 4 years.
Okay, so that's who we're talking to. That's Francis Cooper. Now tell us about tectonics. Big change.
Yes.
What are tectonics as you view them and what the audience would like to know? And then what are the pressing questions that you yourself now, as an independent researcher, are asking?
Well, the surface of the planet is broken up into a series of plates, which are constantly moving around on the surface. And where they interact at their edges, that's where we generate earthquakes. The plates rub up against each other. In some locations, the plates will descend under the plate next to them. That's called subduction. In other areas, they are spreading apart, usually in the middle of the oceans. That's where you grow new crust. And in other places, they slide past each other laterally. As the San Andreas Fault in California is the most famous example on Earth of that. But when they tend to collide together, that's when you generate big mountains.
And so they basically have momentum in different directions.
Yes.
And
so they're crashing towards each
issue.
Other. Yes.
Right.
And so the biggest mountain ranges on the Earth are the Himalayas in Asia, where the Indian plate has been moving northwards and crashing into Asia. And then the second biggest are the Andes in South America. Where you have the Nazca oceanic plate is subducting beneath the South American plate.
A sort of matter of interest, you say that it's the Indian plate moving up. How does one determine that as opposed to the Asian plate moving
well,
down?
Well, it depends on your reference
yeah,
point
okay,
of reference, of
right.
course, yes. But the if we go back in time, about 200 million years ago, there was what was known as a supercontinent of Pangaea, where a lot of the continental masses we know today as separate blocks actually were all combined into one, and then they started to break apart. And India actually was moving relatively quickly relative to Asia. And so if you reconstruct that, India's moving quite quickly. It broke away from Africa and then sort of relatively quickly moved northwards and kept going until it crashed into Asia.
How many million years ago was this?
Pangaea, sort of 200 million years ago, roughly, it started to break apart.
200 million.
And then when it collided with Asia is, you know, these are all matters of debate, but sort of roughly 50 million years ago. Yeah, so around 200 million years ago, Pangaea started to break apart and we started to generate the continental chunks that we're sort of more familiar with when we look at a map today. India was moving pretty quickly and moved northwards until it finally crashed with Asia. And we don't think it necessarily crashed all in one go. There's speculation there may be a sort of zipper effect where it started crashing on one end and then sort of zippered itself closed around 50 million years ago. But that's quite rough and it depends on, you know.
And then, so now I know you've done studies up in the Himalaya.
Yes.
How long did it take for them to be produced? Okay, you've got the initial breakup, India wanders away from wherever it was, Africa area, hits now between the first contact and today. How long does that take?
Well, that's a good question. And that's an active area of research is, you know, how quickly did the mountains grow? How long have they been high for? Because it's not just the Himalayas themselves, which are the really high peaks where you get the sort of 8,000 meter high peaks, Everest obviously being the most famous. But behind that, you have this enormous area of high topography, the Tibetan Plateau. The average elevation of the Tibetan Plateau is about 5,000 meters. And there's a lot of question about, okay, well, when did it get high? Why is it so high? Why is it still so high? People live there, yes.
I mean, I've always amazed when I come here to El Paso, Texas, we're at about 4,500 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. And then I go back to the childhood that you and I shared, and then you think tallest place anywhere was Ben Nevis or Snowdonia, at about 1,500 feet lower than where we're sitting today.
Absolutely.
And so 15,000 feet, the Tibetan Plateau.
It's serious. I mean, working out there, you have to be careful. You have to be sensible. You know, you have to acclimatize slowly. So the nice thing is we did a lot of treks. And when you're doing trekking, rather than just flying into high elevation, getting off the plane and having to acclimatize, you sort of gradually acclimatize as you walk each day. So that's the way to do it.
What did you learn when you were doing your studies there? Tell us, summarize your thesis. I mean, what was it that you went there to learn? And did you learn what you went to find out, or did you find out something totally serendipitous?
Well, so this was my postdoctoral work, not my PhD
thesis. Okay, sorry.
And the main goal was to really try and understand the role that extension plays in the building of the Himalayas, which sounds rather counterintuitive.
Well, we don't understand the word extension.
Okay.
So what does that mean?
So because India has been crashing into Asia, you would expect that all of the deformation is going to be contractional. You're pushing these two continents together, you're piling the rocks up on top of each other, and the faults that do that are known as thrust faults, where you're thrusting material up and over the material below it. But weirdly, in the Himalayas, there is actually evidence that the opposite has also been happening, that you have material sort of being stretched and pulled apart. And the sorts of faults that accommodate that are known as normal faults or extensional faults. So almost all the faults that we see in the Himalayas are contractional. They're thrust faults where material's been stacked up. But right at the very highest elevations of the Himalayas, there is a series of structures known as the South Tibetan Fault System, which are extensional. They're accommodating the opposite sense of motion, where it's as if the material is being extended.
And at the highest levels.
At the highest elevations. And what's really interesting about that is at the very, very top of Mount Everest, there is evidence that this one of these extensional structures exists right at the very top. And just above that, there are marine fossils at the very preserved at the top of Everest that once upon a time, obviously, were on the sea floor. And that just goes to show you, you know, how much deformation there's been, that these have been pushed all the way up to the very top.
That's a good place to break. Just think about that for a moment, and we'll be back shortly. This is Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinnelly and Francis Cooper from the University of Bristol. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinnelly, and Francis Cooper. And that staggering piece of information that right at the very tip of the top of Everest are fossils from marine deposits. That's a big elevation from, let's say, minus 10,000 feet to plus 27 or whatever it is these days.
Absolutely.
And it's still growing. Am I correct?
Growing.
Everest is still going up.
Yes, the fact that those peaks are so high tells you that they're still growing, because as soon as they would stop if the uplift had stopped, the erosion would take over. They'd start eroding away. The rivers would be, you know, removing that material, taking it away, and they'd start decreasing in elevation. The fact they're still so high tells you that collision's still ongoing. They're still being pushed up.
Is it capable of predicting when it will stop? I mean, can one geologists have that capacity these days or no?
I mean, there's no evidence that there's anything slowing down, as far as I know. And so it seems like it's going to keep on, you know,
keep
staying high
trekking.
For quite some time, certainly beyond our lifetimes.
Okay, so let's now switch continents. Let's go to South America.
Yes.
We've got these wonderful Andes Mountains, presumably formed in a similar manner.
Similar, but not quite the same.
So talk about the Andes for us.
So the interesting thing here is that the Andes are the second highest mountain range. And similarly to the Himalayan Tibetan origin, you've got the sort of frontal range high peaks. And then behind that, you have another area of high elevation but low relief known as the Andean Altiplano. And that has an average elevation of about 3.5 kilometers high. So not quite as high as Tibet, but still very, very high.
The main difference, people live there also.
People, of course, live there too. Yeah,
yes,
absolutely. But one of the big differences between the two is that whereas in the Himalaya, you have two continents colliding, so you have India and Asia crashing into each other, and that means you have very thick crust because it's very difficult to subduct continental crust. It's quite buoyant, and so actually you just end up with this big sort of pile of material, very thick. Whereas in the Andes, you're subducting oceanic lithosphere, which is much denser and much thinner beneath continental crust. So you get a more classic subduction zone. And one of the big differences then is that the Andes have volcanoes, whereas the Himalayas don't. And that's because as the material is being subducted down, you release a lot of fluids, a lot of volatiles, and they rise up and you get a lot of melting of the crustal material. And of course, when that reaches the surface, you get a volcano. So the Andes are full of volcanoes, the Himalayas are not.
And they're all active. Well, a lot of them are.
Right. So the magmatic belt has been migrating east over time. And so when you're in the western part of the Andes or in Chile, you've got old extinct volcanoes. And then as you work your way east, they become more active.
Okay, so what's the question that you've been asking for your studies in South America?
Well, interestingly, I took a sort of a slight detour in this research, and I started bringing together tectonics with the question about where we look for copper deposits in the Andes. So South America, and particularly northern Chile, southern Peru, that whole region, contain some of the biggest, most lucrative copper deposits on the planet. And there are big questions about how and where we might find some new ones. And so
this is sort of commercial geology to a certain extent.
It is, but it's
nothing wrong with that, I hasten to add, because Russell is right next to me to correct that errant thought.
Well, of course, there's a 200-year history of people going there for metals? It goes way back.
Yes, absolutely. And there's evidence of, you know, ancient peoples there, you know, discovering copper and using copper in the area.
Just remember a story about how gold was discovered.
Okay.
It was these women walking along the bank somewhere, and they said, "What's that shiny thing? Oh, my gosh. It's gold." That was in Egypt, I think.
Hmm.
Women discovered gold.
Jolly good.
Women do all the best things.
With help from men from time to time, I might add.
Again.
Anyway, so go on. You're trying to find new areas of concentrated ores. I mean, copper is all over the place.
Well,
but in very dilute, if I can use that word.
The thing with they're known as porphyry copper deposits, and the problem with them is that they're what we call high tonnage, low grade. So that in a typical, you know, ton of rock, the percentage of copper you're going to get is maybe 1% copper. So the problem with that is you have to dig an enormous amount of rock out of the ground to get just, you know, a tiny bit of copper out in order to make it worth your while digging it out and selling it. But there are some natural processes that can concentrate that copper and therefore make it easier to dig out of the ground and more lucrative because you get more of bang for your buck, basically. And these processes involve water. So the porphyry copper deposits, primarily, they form deep underground in magmatic systems, which are part of the plumbing systems for the volcanoes we see at the surface. And some of the fluids associated with that will carry metals such as copper. As they are brought towards the surface by a process we call exhumation, yes, I know it sounds a bit like you're into a burial.
Right.
So they're exhumed towards the surface, and as they get very close to the surface, they start to interact with the water table, groundwater, and oxygen from the surface. And reactions, then chemical reactions take place that leach the copper from their primary host minerals, and the copper goes into solution and can be reprecipitated as new minerals in a more concentrated blanket, effectively.
I've seen pictures, and I've actually visited here in New Mexico and Arizona, these enormous, bloody great holes in the ground.
Yes.
Which is this high tonnage, low grade.
Yep.
Are there many of these, there's a
holes.
Term for it,
these places?
That's
enriched.
It, super genes,
yes.
Enriched. Where does one see them?
Well, they still, some of the biggest mines, Chuquicamata is one of the biggest mines in Chile. There was a supergene blanket there, and they dug that out, and now they're going down into what's known as the hypogene, which is the even lower grade.
So the trick for you is to identify where the supergenes are, where these
that's
deposits.
That's exactly right, yes, because they are more lucrative. But bear in mind, although they increase the grade of the copper, we're still only talking maybe 3%, 5%.
Yeah.
So it's still pretty low grade. You know, it's okay. Just that it's better than what was there before. So you still have to have pretty big holes in the ground.
So what are the techniques that you're using to try to locate supergenes? And what's the theory? What's the geology, the science behind your prospecting, if I can call you a prospector?
Well, the big question we had was, this supergene enrichment process requires water to drive it. But the region of northern Chile, southern Peru, is one of the driest places on Earth. It's the Atacama Desert. And so one of the big questions is, okay, well, we know that we need water to drive this process. We know that there are some big supergene-enriched deposits in Chile, but today there's virtually no water around. So when did these things form? When did they stop forming? And what can we, how can we tell where they might exist today if we wanted to go and look for some more of them? And that's where the sort of tectonics comes in, because then that tells us something about when they were exhuming to the surface and reaching the water table, but also the implications for climate. And when did the climate dry out? Presumably it was much wetter in the past, which drove those supergene processes, but it must have stopped at some point because now it's far too dry for them to really be active.
So, I mean, that's interesting. Does the Atacama Desert have underneath, well, actually, I shouldn't say sand. I've got no idea what the Atacama Desert is. Are there fossils there showing it was once deposited?
What do you mean?
Well, that it is, in fact, just like you were talking about top of Everest, that at one stage it was just deposition of material in oceans, sedimentary is what I guess.
Well, most of the rocks are volcanic and magmatic.
Okay.
Because of its long history as a edge of a subduction zone. And so most of the rocks there are the magmatic volcanic rocks that have been brought up.
We've got 5 minutes. What did you find? What after all the work you've done and hiking around this area, what did you find? What did you discover?
Well, actually, I did a lot less hiking here because most of the samples I collected were from drill holes in copper mines. So it was a very different experience to working in Bhutan where I went trekking. What was really interesting for me was the ability to actually not only understand how the copper's formed and where we might look for it, but what the copper formation is telling us about the tectonics. And so it works both ways. So one of the big questions I had is the interplay between tectonics and climate in that region and its effects on the formation of the copper. So one of the sort of chicken and egg questions that we have in this region is, what came first, the rise of the Andes or the onset of the arid climate? So on the one hand, you might say the Andes themselves act as a rain shadow. They're stopping moisture from the Amazon basin to the east, coming across and reaching the Western Andean margin. And that's why it's so dry. One of the reasons it's so dry, it's also to do with global air circulation patterns and dry air coming off the Pacific. But the rise of the Andes is thought to have acted as a rain shadow. On the other hand, there's a chance that the fact it was already dry actually meant that a lot less sediment was being eroded from those mountains and going into the subduction trench. And when you don't have much material going into the subduction zone, you don't have sort of lubrication to move that fault. And so things can kind of get stuck. And if it gets stuck, you can start to build some big mountains. So there's sort of a chicken and egg. Which came first?
So which came first?
So when we analyzed some hematite, which is a byproduct of the supernatant enrichment process, we were able to sort of date when that process took place, gave us some indication of when aridity started, suggesting that the climate may have become arid around sort of 14, 15 million years ago. But there is evidence that the Andes were already pretty high by then. So we think that the aridity occurred after the Andes were already quite high. So,
okay. So that tells you what, in terms of your search for supergenes?
Well, the next question then is, okay, once the climate dries out, it's the supergene process stops. The place we studied, one of the results of the drying of the climate is actually we got some big canyons incised because the rivers were responding to this changing climate. And that canyon incision dropped the water table quite rapidly. And basically those deposits were no longer in the right water-rich zone to keep on generating supergene enrichment. So looking on maps, you know, you'd probably want to be looking at places that hadn't had a big canyon cutting right through them, because that would probably lower your water table and mean that you couldn't continue.
So then
that
you're
process.
Back to traditional prospecting
then
geology.
Then you're back to, but it gives you a little bit more of a feel for the kind of places you might be wanting to look.
We've almost run out of time. This is a very interesting conversation to, you know, Russ and I know nothing about this sort of topic, but we know a little bit about chemistry. But, I mean, how excited are you about the future prospect down there?
What are you going to do next is one of
so many things.
too many things.
Yes. Well, I mean, we've got there's a lot of interesting things we could do in Chile, but also using the same kind of techniques. There are other parts of the world, Arizona, you know, much closer to home, where there
are
similar sized deposits.
You need. You don't need to be close to home. That's the whole point about being a geologist.
Well, not close to my home, to where we're sitting right now.
That's right.
But there's lots of opportunities there. And then we're also looking at working on new projects in the Himalayas and understanding faulting out there. So there's lots of things on the horizon.
And lots of places to go.
Lots more exploring and adventures.
Okay, I think that just about wraps up the time that we've been given. Francis Cooper, University of Bristol, Professor of Geology, traveler, voyager. Absolute pleasure having you here
on
Science Studio.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
So that's the end of Science Studio for this week. I'd like to thank a new person in the booth behind us, Seth Van Maitre. He's the person that's sort of recording it. And Dennis Wu will come in and edit it and take out all the errors that we've made. So we hope you come back after all these errors have been removed, and see you next week with another Science Studio.